Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 111, Psychoanalyzing George W. Bush, September 16th, 2007. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
In this case, it is like George Bush felt that if he talked about his feelings, he would be seen as weak. He would not be a big boy. He would be a weak crybaby. So what he did was he projected weakness and crybabiness onto people around him and became a bully and attacked anybody at school who was weak, because it was a way of attacking a disowned part of himself. And he still does that. He likes to attack weak people, criticize, poke fun. And it's a way of getting rid of this devalued and frightened part of himself.
That was the voice of my guest, Justin A. Frank, M.D. Dr. Frank is a Washington, D.C.-based psychoanalyst and author of the book Bush on the Couch, Inside the Mind of the President, which has a 2007 update. Harvard-trained, he's a member of the Washington Psychoanalytic Institute and is the recipient of numerous teaching awards from George Washington University. He lectures widely on a variety of topics, including psychoanalysis and cinema, especially political movies and the films of Woody Allen, Shakespeare and the Unconscious, the psychoanalytic theory of marriage, psychopolitical life in the nuclear age, the psyche of George W. Bush, and psychopathology of postmodern life. In addition to his recently updated book on the president, his many publications include articles in popular magazines, articles on film theory, and book chapters on psychoanalytic topics. He also writes a blog for thehuffingtonpost.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Justin Frank, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yes, well, I wanted to speak with you about your book, Bush on the Couch, which originally you wrote in 2004, and then you've updated it a couple of times, and I think even most recently you've updated it for this year, 2007. And when I first heard about your book, I thought it might be tongue-in-cheek, but once I picked it up, I quickly discovered that it's quite earnest.
Yes, it's very earnest. I was worried that the title was a little bit, sounded too tongue-in-cheek, but I wasn't sure what else to call it, and it's a very serious book.
Yes. I think I'd like to start out by reading a little bit from the book, because at the very beginning of the book, you set out a number of key paradoxes or questions about George Bush that kind of guided your study. So let me read from that to get us started. You write, "How can someone so friendly and playful be the same person who cuts funds from government programs aiding the poor and hungry? How is it that our deeply religious president feels free to bomb Iraq and then celebrate the results with open expressions of joy? How can a president send American soldiers into combat under false pretenses and then proceed to joke about the deception, finding humor in the absence of weapons of mass destruction under his Oval Office desk? How can someone promise to protect the environment on the one hand and allow increased arsenic in the public water supply on the other? And why does he feel he can call his plan to lift logging restrictions in national forests the, quotes, Healthy Forest Initiative? If the president's interpersonal skills are strong enough to earn him the reputation of being a, quotes, free person, why was he so unwilling and even unable to talk about world leaders or to talk to world leaders such as Jacques Chirac or Gerhard Schroeder, who disagreed with him? And finally, you write, how can the president sound so confused and yet act so decisively? And given the regularity with which he confuses fact with fantasy, how can he justify decisions based largely on his own personal suspicions with such unwavering certainty? So those are certainly good questions to start out with. And I'm wondering, what's your reply to people who will inevitably say that you are politically motivated and out to get him?
Well, I certainly feel that everybody who is in the world has, hopefully, has some political point of view. So in that sense, I am a political person. I think that it's important, though, for people who are interested in psychology and psychoanalysis to be able to make a link between those two things. I have a long-time liberal anti-war person. I've definitely not liked George Bush's policies. There are other people whose policies I haven't liked, including some Democrats, in particular Lyndon Johnson during the war in Vietnam. But I'm not out to get him in that one of the things that happens when you are a psychoanalyst is that as you begin to get to know someone, you find out all kinds of things and you find their humanity. So it's very interesting that the people who are criticizing the book do not criticize me that I'm out to get him. And in fact, people who are conservative politically who've read the book don't have much to disagree with about him, the man. It's really quite interesting. I found things that that he shares that we all are more human than not, and I found things about him that reminded me of aspects of myself and people I know and all kinds of things. So I don't feel that I was out to get him. I do feel that he has is seriously flawed psychologically, and because of those flaws, not because of his politics, but because of those flaws, I have questions about whether he should be president.
Okay. The idea of now, you've never seen him to actually psychoanalyze
right.
him. He's not come to visit you. He's not laid down on the couch or anything. And the idea of remotely analyzing or psychoanalyzing a public figure isn't new. And in fact, you refer to it as applied psychoanalysis. Maybe you can just tell us a little bit what you mean by applied psychoanalysis and give us some other historical examples.
Well, yes, applied psychoanalysis is a discipline in and of itself, and more there have been different periods in our history, in the history of psychoanalysis, when psychoanalysts did write biographies of famous people. But applied psychoanalysis is the application of psychoanalytic principles to the study of a historical figure or a famous person who will never come into your consulting room or use your couch. But you use psychoanalytic principles in investigating that person. For instance, you read and learn everything possibly that you can. You look for patterns. You look for patterns of behavior. You try to make links between past and present. This has been a long tradition that actually started in the early days of psychoanalysis. Freud did a couple of cases like that. He did a psychoanalysis of Moses and
yes.
also one of Michelangelo. And then in his later years, after World War I, he did one with another man about Woodrow Wilson, interestingly. And then in the 40s, President Roosevelt hired a psychoanalyst in Boston, Fritz Redlich, and another one, Jack Murray, two of them actually, to write psychoanalytic, to do studies of Hitler with the aims for him to understand Hitler and how he worked so that after the war, he would have a stronger possibility of negotiating with him and understanding where he was coming from. Both men, of course, died before the war was over, but the original analysis of Hitler, which I have not read, is still there in Hyde Park at the Roosevelt estate. Then in the 60s, the CIA started doing this. They would hire psychiatrists and psychoanalysts and psychologists to analyze foreign leaders, again, at arm's length, with the idea of understanding their behavior and having a better way both to negotiate with them and deal with them.
Now, maybe
so
you'd have
a long pattern of this.
Okay, maybe you'd have to kill me to answer this question, but were you ever hired by the CIA to do that?
I won't have to kill you, and no, I wasn't, but several of my students were hired by the CIA. One of my the residents under me at GW was worked for the CIA for about 8 or 10 years, and I have a good friend who works for the CIA, Gerald Post. I don't think he does now, but he was very active in and has written a lot about the process of how they do their work. I mean, without revealing any deep and dark secrets.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's really fascinating. Now, I get the impression that when it comes to applied psychoanalysis, your book might be unique in as much as it's the first analysis of a sitting president. Do
yeah.
I have that right?
Yes, you have that right. It's unique. It's the first analysis of a sitting president. There have been people who've analyzed the former presidents and done psychobiographies of a variety of people in the past, but nobody has ever analyzed the sitting president. It's a difficult situation because in 1964, when Barry Goldwater was running for the Republican Party against Lyndon Johnson, there were a lot of people who were afraid because of Goldwater's tough talk that he would actually end up using nuclear weapons, that he was not a safe person because of his deep-seated hatred of Russia and communism.
Yes.
And so there was a questionnaire circulated around among psychiatrists, I think it was, not psychologists, but psychiatrists at the American Psychiatric Association. Did they think that Goldwater was stable enough to have his finger on the nuclear trigger? And a huge number of them said no, they didn't think so. And that was used in the campaign by Johnson. And since then, there was a rule passed in the American Psychiatric that made it unethical to do that kind of thing and to analyze a sitting president. Those people in the questionnaire were not doing analysis. I mean, I really studied George Bush for 2 years before I wrote my book, so it's not like that I was just filling out a questionnaire. But it did set psychoanalytic analysis of sitting presidents and public figures back quite a bit. And I felt that I was taking a big risk ethically in terms of the canons of my profession, and I, in fact, called a very good friend of mine who was the president and is, I think, still the president of the American Psychiatric Association. And I warned him about my book before it was coming out. And I told him that I didn't want to undermine our profession or anything like that. I'm very proud of being a psychiatrist. And he and I trained together in Boston and we were very close friends. And he appreciated my warning because I said I was worried that there would be bad publicity, but there really wasn't much.
Well, that's interesting. I'm glad to hear that. Now, your work is theoretically rooted in the work of Melanie Klein,
yes.
a psychoanalyst, very influential psychoanalyst from the past, and some of her ideas about birth trauma. Maybe you can kind of give us a thumbnail sketch of that, since all of my listeners may not be up to date in terms of psychoanalytic theory.
Well, then you
can tell us whether or not Bush suffered an unusual traumatic birth.
Well, I don't know about the birth. She was not so much interested, although I did write in my book about birth trauma a little bit. But her main, Melanie Klein, was, although trained in Europe, became a British, moved to England in the 20s and was known essentially as a British psychoanalyst. And she was quite revolutionary because she really was interested in the importance of certain factors in a person's development. One of them is the importance of the ability to mourn and face loss, and that's a central to growth. Another thing that she wrote about was the importance of recognizing destructiveness in yourself and recognizing sadism and cruelty, which unless you recognize it, it makes it very, and accept it, since we all have little bits of that, or maybe lots of bits of that. It makes it much harder to love if you don't recognize your own potential to hurt other people. And she was very interested in the issues of weaning and loving and hating the same person and looking at ambivalence. And I think that a lot of her theories really have informed my work really since the beginning of my training, which is now over 30 years ago. And in the case of George Bush, one of the things that happened early in his life was that when he was the firstborn, and when he was 3 and a half, he had a sister born, and that's happens to everybody who's firstborn, lots of people. But when he was 7 years old, his sister died of leukemia, and at the same time as she died, his brother Jeb, I think maybe 2 months before she died, was born. So his mother's attention was really elsewhere, and he was left to his own devices. And in the family, because of the nature of that family, there was really no mourning for the dead sister, who was really his only playmate, it seemed like. And there was no funeral. They never talked about her. Her name was Robin. And so there was this pattern set early on that things that are painful are not talked about. They're not looked at. They're not discussed. And that was something that he carried with him all of his life, and to this day doesn't really like to talk about any kind of painful thing. And in fact, one of the ways of managing it was one of the things that Mrs. Klein, Naomi Klein, wrote about that was so important was, although Freud had written about it too, about the concept of projection, which is attributing a quality in yourself that you don't like, attributing that quality to somebody else.
Sure.
You know, in the slang, it's like the pot calling the kettle black.
Yeah.
But in this case, it is like George Bush felt that if he talked about his feelings, he would be seen as weak. He would not be a big boy. He would be a weak crybaby. So what he did was he projected weakness and crybabiness onto people around him and became a bully and attacked anybody at school who was weak, because it was a way of attacking a disowned part of himself. And he still does that. He likes to attack weak people, criticize, poke fun, and it's a way of getting rid of this devalued and frightened part of himself.
Yes. Now, the psychoanalytic approach, of course, emphasizes the formative importance of the early years of life,
yes,
as you're pointing out. And so, not surprisingly, you do spend some time dwelling on that in the book.
Yes.
What are some other points that are salient in terms of Bush's family and the early years?
Well, one of the things that's interesting in psychoanalysis also is patterns that are passed on from generation to generation. Mrs. Klein, Naomi Klein, didn't write so much about that, but other psychoanalysts do. And one of the things that was very interesting was that George Bush's mother, Barbara, her mother died, and Barbara Bush did not go to her own mother's funeral. And Barbara Bush's mother was not very mothering and never cooked for Barbara. And George Bush kids his mother, Barbara, about the same thing, that she never cooked for him, that every time she wanted to cook something, she would get freezer burn.
Hmm.
And that there are patterns that were passed on through generations of a disconnected mother. One thing that's important in early life is that it's really important for a baby to be able, and a young child, to see itself or himself reflected in the mother's eyes. In other words, when you smile, it's important for the mother to smile back. When you're a little baby and have a certain feeling or a certain experience, it's important for that to be reflected back. But if the mother is depressed or if the mother is emotionally disconnected, the child doesn't get that kind of feedback and then desperately searches for it elsewhere. And he became a person who searched for that feedback elsewhere at school, when he became a class clown and a kind of a teasing bully.
Yeah.
Because his mother was really either depressed or disconnected. And if you read her memoirs, there's hardly any mention of her firstborn son, George.
Hmm.
And a great deal of time is about Jeb and the kids who came after.
Wow. And why would that be? Why would that be?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know why. I'm sorry I'm interrupting you, but I think that some of it's about the idea that I think unconsciously, and this is just speculation, obviously, that she must have linked George and the dead daughter Robin as a mm-hmm. first part of her life, and then having Jeb was the part of a new beginning. So the next kids were the ones that she writes about most and was most connected to.
That's very interesting. Now, people could get the impression that you're a Bush hater, but in fact, you acknowledged at the beginning of this discussion and also in the book, you note a number of his positive qualities. What are some of those?
Well, one of the things that his positive qualities are, I think he has a great sense of humor. He's amazingly resilient. I mean, he's been attacked and criticized, and he just is able to stand up. He's able to be unwaveringly certain at times, which is definitely a form of strength. He was able to stop drinking when he was about 40. He had been a very heavy drinker in terms of trying to manage his anxiety and all of the agitation he was feeling. And he was really a ne'er-do-well. He never made it in the world of business and never was successful. And he ran unsuccessfully for Congress in 78, I think. And he didn't stop drinking until, 1986, when he was 40. But the capacity to do that is a great strength of character. So he does have certain kinds of strengths. He's extremely loyal to his friends. He's affectionate. People who know him, in fact, when the week after the book came out, I was having breakfast in Washington, and at the next table was Steve Hadley, who's now the head of the NSA, the National Security Agency. And Steve and I are old friends, and he came up to me, and he congratulated me on the book, and then he asked me if I had really met President Bush, and I said, no, I hadn't. And we talked a little bit about him. He said, that I'd really like him, that he was really a good guy.
That's interesting.
So I discovered those things about him.
And at the same time, with these positive qualities, there are contradictions in his personality, right?
Yes. He has this cruel streak that if he were just a used car salesman or somebody, I don't mean against that, but just somebody you'd meet in a bar, you could sort of deal with his cruelty. But when you're president of the United States, it becomes very unsettling. He teases people. He puts people down. He has a delinquent side of himself that he's always had. He's always been delinquent in one form or another, whether it's from fake IDs for early age drinking to signing statements as an adult where they pass laws, and then he says, well, I don't have to obey these laws. And he just writes a signing statement and dismisses them. And he's written more signing statements by far than any president previously. These sides of him, and then there's the alcoholism, and then there's this kind of real cruel streak that he's always had. He used to torture animals when he was little. He would... when he was in college, he would use hot coat hangers, and as part of pledging at Yale, he would brand the buttocks of freshman recruits. These are things that are pretty cruel, I think. And then he would deny them and minimize them. So one of the things that I wrote about in the book was at one point it became public what he was doing when he was in the fraternity because of his family name was so famous. So he was interviewed by a New York Times reporter when he was a senior at the Yale, and because of his name, Bush. And when asked about branding pledges, he said, look, it's nothing worse than a cigarette burn. It's not a big deal. And when you read that, you do a double take and you say, well, wait a minute, who goes around burning people with cigarettes?
Right.
And the fact that he could just dismiss it like this, and it's the same way, I think when he was a child, his parents dismissed the death of his sister. They would dismiss people's troubles. And you see this now with his mother, how she was about the people in Katrina when they were at the Superdome and Astrodome, and she dismissed their, she said, well, this is probably a better place for them anyway, or something like that. She was very dismissive. They dismiss other people's troubles, which for me, in the unconscious thinking about it, is really a sign of cruelty. mm-hmm. And sadism.
In your psychoanalytic narrative, the management of anxiety is a key thread. Maybe you can talk something about that, about his defensive style of how he, where his anxiety comes from, and then how he manages that.
I'm really glad you brought that up, because anxiety, it's funny, here I am, Kleinian. One of the main concerns of Kleinian theory and focuses, foci of Kleinian theory is anxiety and the importance, the centrality of anxiety in psychic development, that people are very anxious. And there's two kinds of anxiety. There's what she calls paranoid anxiety, which means a fear that somebody's going to hurt you, that you're afraid of somebody in the world, like people talking, when they talk about Oedipus, they talk about a castrating father, a fear that the father's going to attack you. That's called paranoid anxiety. And she felt that that kind of fear is based on projection. In other words, that the child wants to attack the father, but that wish is so painful and scary that he projects his attacking wish and then feels that he's going to be attacked. So that's one kind of anxiety, paranoid anxiety. And the other kind of anxiety is what she calls anxiety when you love and hate the same person and you're afraid that your anger at that person will destroy the loved person. That's called ambivalence. And she was very focused on how people go out of their way to manage their anxiety. And I think George Bush had a tremendous amount of anxiety. When the mother is disconnected, if a baby cries, a mother or father will pick up the baby and calm them and cuddle them and hold them. But if the baby is really left to his own devices, he has no outside agent to help manage his anxiety, and he's left having to manage it himself. And one of the ways people manage anxiety when they're children is by becoming very hyperactive, and they run around and they discharge their anxiety in motoric ways. Well, that's sort of what he did. And so he was always trying to manage his anxiety. He had different kinds of twitches. He would, one way of managing his anxiety would be to be a bully. If you can bully other people, you don't feel as scared or anxious. Later on in life, he managed his anxiety by drinking, and he, the best way to manage anxiety for many people, and, you know, coming home from a hard day's work when you're anxious, you have a drink. Well, he was a very heavy drinker, and we all find different ways to manage anxiety. But one of the things that's so important as a psychoanalyst is that anxiety itself can be a source of information, not something that you have to run away from, but it might have some meaning. So like if you're anxious before a speech you're going to give, or you're anxious about something, it means you should pay attention to it. And it's a signal that you need to pay attention to. But Bush was trying to deaden his anxiety completely. And then when he stopped drinking, he really had no other way to manage his anxiety throughout. He couldn't manage it through alcohol, so he had to find other ways. And that's when he turned to religion and to massive exercise. And he also smoked a lot of cigarettes, a very heavy chain smoker, which isn't really talked about much by people, but he was a very heavy smoker. And that's a way to manage anxiety. He still has to manage anxiety now by spending a lot of time away from the White House. He manages anxiety by constantly exercising, by having very short meetings and brief meetings. And he manages anxiety by making sure that every person that he speaks to has been vetted and screened as somebody who would not challenge him or threaten him. And remember in the April 2004 press conference, when somebody asked him if he'd ever made a mistake, he sort of froze and became paralyzed and couldn't really answer that question. And that's what happens when a person who is so used to managing their anxiety by evading it, when they're confronted directly, they really don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm. You talk about him having stopped drinking, and but you also describe him as a dry drunk, and you list some sort of telltale characteristics. Can you take us through that?
Well, yes, that's a term. The dry drunk is actually not a medical term. So even though I used the term, I was trying to be careful to talk about it as a term that makes sense to me, but it's not clinically used in psychiatry and psychoanalysis. But people in AA use it, and it's a very meaningful term, which is that somebody who has stopped drinking, who's an alcoholic, they've stopped drinking, but they have not gotten rid of the alcoholism, the ism part of alcoholism. And that includes people who also can't manage anxiety, people who have to see the world in black and white. One of the ways of managing anxiety is to simplify things. You're with us or you're against us. Mm-hmm. You're a good guy or you're a bad guy. That's a way of managing anxiety, and it's typical of dry drunks. Dry drunks are at times very impulsive, and they cling to the same idea. They can't change their mind about anything. And so he has clung to this idea about Iraq, for instance, and that's very typical of dry drunks. They get angry and very suspicious, and they're very much like, and they become sometimes full of braggadocio, like they can say, an alcoholic would say, I can lick any man in the house, I can beat up anybody. That's sort of the way he says, bring them on. It's very typical of the dry drunk. I'm sorry, there's a phone coming in.
Oh, yes, I was hearing a little cutout there.
Yeah, that's there's okay. A call waiting on my phone.
Okay. So, that's okay.
I won't pick it up.
You even raised the possibility in relation to his drinking that he may be suffering from some brain impairment as a result of his period of very heavy drinking.
Well, it's really striking how, has trouble thinking things through. He makes lots of slips of the tongue. He has trouble organizing his mind, and he has other cognitive deficits that I think he has. I mean, it's too bad that he has not been tested psychologically. But one of the things that can happen in people who have chronic alcoholism, and he was a heavy drinker for 24 years of his life, is that about 15% of people don't ever get back to their pre-morbid state, in other words, to the state they were at before they started drinking. But most people do recover fully their mental processes, but there's something about him. I've had several patients and a couple of colleagues who wondered about him being kind of early stages of an alcoholic syndrome where you're disorganized, where you deny things that you just said. You could say something and then somebody would quote you and you would say, well, I never said that. And he did this recently with George Stephanopoulos when he was interviewed, and Stephanopoulos asked him about staying the course, you know, and how can he keep insisting on staying the course. And George Bush finally said to him, look, I've never been about stay the course. I never said stay the course. And, I mean, my blood ran cold when he said that, when I saw that interview. Because it means that he's denying everything that he's been saying for the previous 2 years. People who have alcoholic brain damage do that more than other people. But there are lots of people who will deny things that they've said because they're uncomfortable about them when they hear somebody else say them. I just heard about a case today. So I don't think that's unique to him. Mm-hmm.
You talked about the motoric expression as one way of handling anxiety, and you actually did explore or raise the possibility that he may have suffered from ADHD and dyslexia.
Yes.
Yeah. What can you tell us about that?
Well, he has trouble. His brother is a very well-diagnosed Neil Bush dyslexic who really virtually cannot read. George Bush has a very difficult time reading. He doesn't like to read. He has to be briefed by his advisors. He doesn't read the documents that he gets. They come to his desk and other people read them to him. And so I think he does have a serious reading problem. But He also has a kind of attention deficit hyperactive disorder. I really think he's unable to sit still. If you watch films of him when he was governor, he was always fidgeting around, touching people, being really unable to sit still. There are several different interesting pictures of him sitting when other people are speaking at an awards event when he was governor, and he would just get up and touch people and tap people and very much hyperactive. And one of the ways of managing anxiety is to constantly be on the move and constantly try to discharge it.
Now,
I think, well, go ahead.
Well, I can't help but wonder, you know, how can a guy who can't read, who doesn't want to read, doesn't like to read, get through Princeton, let alone, you know, become president?
Well, he went to Harvard, not Princeton.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I don't know if he could get to Princeton, but he went to Yale, actually.
And oh, Yale, yes, that's right.
Because of his father, and in those days they had legacies, and I guess they still do, but he, his father was a star at Yale, and his whole family and his grandfather went to Yale, so he has a long family history. And they, in these Ivy League schools, they want to take people in the family so they can get endowments and family money. And Yale is no exception. In fact, it was fairly well known in those days. And so he could get through by just getting what's called a gentleman's C. He probably couldn't read very well. And he didn't do very well in school, but he managed to get through. He also got into Harvard Business School, which was really interesting for me. How he did, I don't know. I don't think he reads very well. Now, there's lots of people who have dyslexia and trouble reading who do very well in life. There are most of them, many of them are in acting, you know. They memorize scripts. They have other people read to them and they memorize scripts, or they read slowly and they memorize things. It's laborious. Mm-hmm. I mean, the issue is not that he couldn't read at all, but that it was really hard work to read.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that a lot of people who don't, and he is not averse to hard work in that way, and so maybe he just did power his way through. I don't know. But clearly it's not anything of choice for him, reading.
Well, let me kind of cut to the chase here and ask you, is there any danger that as an evangelical Christian who believes in the apocalypse, that this president would be motivated to bring about the end of the world as we know it in order to hasten Christ's return?
Well, that's a tough question, because my first answer is a qualified yes. There is a danger. What makes it even more dangerous is that I think at his deepest level of his psychic organization, he really hates his parents, in particular, well, both of them. And I think that unfortunately he is confusing the American people with his parents. And I think that he is doing destructive things willfully to the American people. He is destroying our army. And he really is. He is sending them out there and without any plans, preparation, or support. He is bankrupting the government, and he's doing that, I think, on purpose, because I think he really is destructive. He broke all kinds of treaties. He likes to break things. He's a very angry man that he's covered up with his affability and his charm, but that he really is a destructive person. I think that I don't see him as evangelical as some people might see him, because I don't think he's deeply religious. I think that he takes advantage of other people's religiosity, but I don't see him as being deeply religious. But I think that he's deeply destructive.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I hate to stop, but I'm going to actually have to get off.
Okay, then
from this interview.
I'm sorry, because I had another question or two.
Okay, what's your last question? I'm just getting these calls, and they may be from patients, and I can't tell.
Okay, well, have you taken any heat for writing this book from the president, his administration, the neocons, psychiatry?
I've taken some heat from psychiatry in the first few months, and anybody who criticized the book, I actually wrote them a letter, and I said, why don't you read the book, and then you can criticize it.
Right.
And I never heard back from them. As far as politically, it was the same thing. The people who criticized it were the people who hadn't read it. And I had my office burgled a couple of times, and my friends told me that it might be like the FBI or somebody, you know, trying to make a big mess. But I don't buy that. And so I actually don't think I took much less heat than I thought I would. But the other thing that happened is that I got ignored by the major mainstream press. Mm-hmm. I think that like the headlines in the New York Times book review was the thing that the book on Swift voting or the attacks on Hillary, but a book written by a legitimate psychoanalyst who's a professor and well-trained at Harvard, that book was not reviewed and didn't get much press. It was ignored, and I think that they're anxious about it. So in that sense, the only negative feedback I got was no feedback from some people.
Okay, well, I'm going to let... I can well imagine, and I'm going to encourage my listeners to read the book. Dr. Justin Frank, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
I hope you found this interview with Dr. Justin Frank as stimulating as I did. For me, it was one of the most fascinating ones yet, and I was especially excited to be able to land Dr. Frank as an interview. I'm grateful to my friend Jerry Trumbull, whom you've heard on several earlier episodes, for making me aware of Dr. Frank's book and suggesting him as a guest. I went ahead with this interview with some trepidation that I might alienate politically conservative listeners. So I hope I haven't lost you. If you're still listening, good for you. I hope you're still with us here and haven't canceled your subscription. It's true, as you probably figured out, that I'm politically liberal. But there are people on both sides of the fence who question the behavior of this president. I think the sorts of questions Dr. Frank raises are ones that intelligent people in the U.S. and especially outside it are haunted by. Regardless of your political stance, this interview gives us good insight into the psychoanalytic approach and into what Dr. Frank calls applied psychoanalysis, referring to the analysis of historical and political figures. As you heard, this approach is considered to have a solid enough foundation that it's used by intelligence agencies, for better or worse. And I'll bet our government isn't the only one that engages in this sort of analysis of political leaders and foes. Unfortunately, Dr. Frank ran out of time. I would have liked to ask him more questions. I also was hoping to get to one that I think he might have found challenging, but hopefully not mean-spirited. I wanted to ask him something along the lines of, well, let's have you turn the psychoanalytic beam back on yourself. What do you know about yourself that you'd have the chutzpah to go after the big guy? Might some people say you have a father complex? Unfortunately, we'll never know the answer to that question. I would have asked it half in jest. At the same time, though, I think it's a fair question. From a psychoanalytic point of view, I'd have to speculate that there is something in his unique psyche that drove him to write this unique book. It is, in fact, a unique and important book, in my opinion, and I think you'll find it a compelling and provocative read if you have the time and courage to do so.
That's right. Shrink Wrap Radio. Coming at you now. Yo, everybody, let's get down. There's a new MC in town. Talking psychology interviews. Dr. Dave is all the rave. Ain't no slouch on the digital couch. He's on the pod. Podcast. Got the pod. Yeah. You want to be in the know? No. Talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. All right.
Thanks again to Jeff Smith for yet another inspired musical implementation of one of my ideas for a new Shrink Wrap Radio jingle. I've long thought I should have something that plays on the rap angle in the title of Shrink Wrap Radio, but I didn't want anything too harsh. And I think this one strikes the right balance. What do you think? As I'm sure you know by now, this show has two sponsors, Podshow and GoDaddy. It's easy for me to recommend both of them to you because I honestly feel good about both of them. Most of you who listen to this show get it through iTunes. I don't think iTunes would be carrying podcasts if Adam Curry, founder of Podshow and widely known as the Podfather, had not met with Steve Jobs and convinced him of the importance of podcasting. The fact that podcasts appear in the iTunes store has probably done more for podcasting than anything else that anyone has done so far. So, if for no other reason than that, I'm happy to promote Podshow. And GoDaddy is easy for me to promote because I use them, and I use my discount code of Shrink3 for every domain name and website that I set up. So I'm feeling lucky to have had sponsors that I can feel good about promoting. And now I'm feeling triply blessed because Podshow has invited me to take part in a new promotion, which is for the forthcoming Sony Pictures movie, We Own the Night. Now, this is perfect for me because one of my guilty pleasures is I am totally addicted to the movies in general and to that sort of crime genre in particular. Most weekends, I get together with a good buddy of mine who lives about 70 miles away, and we both travel to Marin County, which is about halfway between us, to meet for lunch and a movie. And when we plan out our movie over the phone, we'll frequently say, oh, we have to see such and such a movie because it's one of, quotes, our movies, end quotes, meaning our kind of action, suspense, thriller, crime movie. And I think we already saw the previews for We Own the Night in the theater, and we'd already labeled it as one of our must-see movies. So you can see why this promotion is a perfect match for me. So for this show and the next three shows, you'll be hearing me talk about this upcoming movie, which I am, in fact, truly looking forward to. Don't forget to take our new poll on the Shrink Wrap Radio site, which asks the question, how often do you worry? Also, while you're on the Shrink Wrap Radio site, don't forget to look for the link to the Shrink Wrap Radio Fan Club on Facebook. If enough people go there, it could become a community gathering place for like-minded folks. And let me remind you again of my other podcast series, Wise Counsel, where you'll find a new interview with Dr. Joan Gillespie, who I also interviewed here. And the Wise Counsel interview there is completely different from the one that I did here. And you'll find that interview along with a free written transcript at www.wisecounselpodcast.com. And hey, we have a new addition to our Frapper map. Axel in London writes, I'm a neurologist / psychiatrist / psychotherapist using cognitive behavioral therapy and hypnosis. Well, Axel, thanks for taking time to put yourself on our map, and I'm always thrilled to hear about such accomplished professionals as yourself. Perhaps you'd like to be a guest. Contact me if you fancy that idea.
Hi, this is Gary Goodwin from Alexandria, Virginia, at the International Association for the Study of Dreams Dream Conference. Wake up from your dream with Dr. Dave.
Thanks, Gary from Virginia. Gary's one of our listeners who came up and introduced himself at the Dream Conference. It was a real treat to meet him. And Gary, I hope you're still listening. So let's see what we have in the way of recent emails. Here's one that says, Dear Dr. Dave, I know how much you love hearing from listeners abroad, so I thought I'd send perhaps your first fan letter from Japan. I've been a faithful listener since May of this year when I purchased my first iPod. As I've been living abroad for the past 7 years, first as a Peace Corps volunteer in Central Asia, and now as an English teacher in Japan, I was feeling quite out of touch with the academic world and searched iTunes for educational podcasts. As an aspiring school counselor, marriage family therapist, your show immediately caught my interest. I don't have an undergraduate background in psychology and was hoping to find podcasts that could help fill in some gaps in my general awareness and knowledge of topics in the field. I must say that the combination of your Shrink Wrap Radio and Wise Counsel shows have helped me a great deal in doing this. In particular, I found your interviews with Dr. Joni Gillespie very relevant to my work with adolescents here in Japan. I'm currently training for my first full marathon, and I listen to your shows on my weekly long runs as a reward for my exertion. As I embark on the adventure of applying to graduate programs back in the States, I'm originally from Southern Oregon, I appreciate the many potential paths both you and the guests on your show have lit for me. With respectful regards, Alicia. Alicia, thanks very much for that. And hey, there's a whole new audience for me, marathon runners. They've got a lot of time on their hands, or should I say time on their feet. And certainly wish you good luck as you begin to move towards a career that's more centered on counseling. Now, the next email is from Al, who writes, I've been listening to Shrink Wrap in more or less random order, and the same for Are You Serious show. I just hit an episode where you asked if anyone had heard you there on the Are You Serious show, where Are You interviewed me, and subsequently I subscribed to Shrink Wrap. He says, me, enjoying your show, Al. So, Al, I really appreciate getting that news. I like the Are You Serious show a lot myself, and so I was quite pleased to have an opportunity to appear there as a guest. And I really wondered if anybody who heard me there would be interested in listening to Shrink Wrap Radio. So now I know that at least there was one person, and it wasn't a wasted trip. The next one is from Lloyd in Australia, who you may recall. And he's commenting on my last show or a previous show with Dr. David Lukov on spiritual emergencies, in which we also touched on the issue of psychedelic drugs and what's going on there. And Lloyd writes, Hi, David. Great last episode. It's important to get the news out there that LSD and MDMA might not be such evil chemicals after all and have valid and important psychological uses. Not sure anybody important is listening to that message, though. Also, just listen to Are You Serious episode number 37 on the same subject. If you've never heard that one, check it out. It contains an amazing story about the corruption of the head government expert on MDMA. I'm not sure if I've heard that one or not. I know I've listened to a lot of his shows. I'll have to look at his back catalog. Lloyd goes on to say, and thanks heaps for promoting my podcast. It really made my day. I haven't been getting many hits or any email, so that side has been a little disappointing. However, the therapeutic value of making them has been great and really does seem to have a positive effect on clearing out all my, quotes, emotional junk left over from previous times. Love the new theme song. He's referring to not the one from this episode, but the one previously that was kind of Beatlesque. He says, it's actually a good song in itself, inspired by the Beatles' LSD-era music, which is my favorite time for them. And Lloyd, you correctly recognize that. And let me give his podcast another plug here. You'll find it at www.elizapodcast.com. And Eliza is spelled E-L-I-Z-A. So how about giving Lloyd a little bit of a rush by checking it out and making a comment there? Next, Miranda in South Carolina writes, Dear Dr. Dave, thank you so much for your show. It has entertained, amused, inspired, and facilitated my personal growth and healing since I received my iPod for Christmas 2006. I've listened to all of your shows, some more than twice. Psychology in its myriad forms has played a defining role in both my personal and professional lives. Your work and the expertise of your guests have truly been crucial to the health and survival of my entire family. As a classroom teacher of 20 years, I was working on a doctorate in psychology when first medical interventions for infertility, and then the birth of a fabulous baby boy who required 3 heart surgeries in his first year of life, sidelined both my professional and academic careers. The time spent caring for him in hospital during these intense life-or-death procedures triggered memories of my own childhood, in-hospital traumas I had experienced decades before, as well as the remembrance of a near-death experience I had as a young child after a botched surgery. It has been a difficult road for our little family, dealing with heart defects, my PTSD, our family's financial bankruptcy due to catastrophic medical bills, my husband's loss of his career in finance due to the aforementioned bankruptcy, and my subsequent hospitalization against my will in one of the nation's worst psychiatric hospitals for what appeared to be a, quote, psychotic episode, close quote, but was in actuality withdrawal from a psychotropic drug I was taking as directed by a physician. During this so-called psychotic episode, I experienced a healing crisis or spiritual emergency, which further confounded my recovery. I lost my job due to this hospitalization and worked for over a year through a federal agency to seek restitution for this illegal dismissal from my job. Ultimately, I succeeded in winning only a token monetary award, but this small victory contributed greatly to our family's path to healing. Somehow, through all these ordeals, my knowledge base from my own study of psychology and my belief in the healing power of psychiatry and psychotherapy when practiced with skill and compassion kept me seeking help from the right professionals. You can no doubt see how the varied topics and themes of your shows have resonated with my experience and helped me feel connected to a like-minded community. My son is now 8 and thriving in all areas of life. I'm feeling less and less like a gal who walks around with a bullseye on my back with the universe while the universe does its target practice, and more like a graceful recipient of the wisdom and generosity of skilled healers who have worked within my family's financial limitations and still provided impeccable medical, individual, and conjoint therapies. Dr. Dave, you, your podcast, and your guests are some of the blessings I count each night. I haven't ever written a letter quite like this one to someone I've never even really met, but if I'm that only one person that makes your work worth it, you deserve to know it. Many thanks and all my love for what you do. And then she says, P.S., I've kissed a lot of frogs in searching for my medical doctor and talk therapist. If you ever want to interview great private practitioners so your listeners can get a feel for what good ones sound like and learn how they work together to help a patient, I know 2 fabulous professionals you can talk to. Well, Miranda, what a touching story. You and your family have really gone through the ringer, and yet it's such a testimonial to the resilience of the human personality and of your particular resilience and inner strength that you've bounced back from that with as positive an attitude as you demonstrate here. And of course, I'm very happy for whatever sustenance you've been able to take from this show. And yeah, let me know about those possible guests. They sound like they would be good ones. Now, the next one really grabbed my attention. This guy knows how to write a subject line, because the subject set line in the email said, "Shrink Wrap Radio Saves Lives." So you can imagine I opened that up right away. "Dear Dr. Dave, your pod show has saved my life and my family's, literally. It's the only thing that keeps me awake and alert while I'm making my 2-hour weekly commute from Roseburg, Oregon to Corvallis, Oregon. I've been listening for over a year now, and I really enjoy how the show and your persona as a podcaster continues to develop. I really think that what you're doing is not only avant-garde, but noble. You are increasing insight and awareness on an international level without the get-rich agenda of Dr. Phil." Thank you, although I wouldn't mind a little bit of this get-rich. But, you know, I don't need it. I'm doing okay. He goes on to say, after listening to over 100 shows now, there are so many things that I can comment on. But this is my first email here, and so here are just a few to get me started. One, many of your listeners are interested in career options in the field, but I have only really heard the choices of psychologist, including professor, researcher, and clinician, and coaching. I've been working in the field for only 7 years and have held many jobs not yet mentioned that someone entering the field might be interested in. I've moved from case management, addictions counselor, clinical counselor, and now I'm a program director in a nonprofit agency. Along the way, I've worked with PhDs, PsyDs, LCSWs, MSWs, LADACs, CGACs, LPCs, LPCCs, RNs, LPNs, CNSs, and CPSs. The alphabet soup is almost endless, as you can see in my signature line that I have a few acronyms that could also use some explaining. At any rate, I would like to volunteer my experience and the lessons that I have learned on the front lines to help people explore different paths on their journey. Okay, I am assuming that you're volunteering to be a guest on the show. If that's what you mean, let me know. Or if you just rather that I announce your availability of your email address or phone number, I do that as well. He goes on to point two. It was very refreshing to hear your interview with Gail Delaney, PhD. I, too, am fascinated with dreams and have used them in my work with others as well as my own personal work. However, I've been reluctant to comment on your conversations on the topic thus far because of your tendency toward interpreting the dreams of others. I practice the Gestalt method, sans interpretation, of course, and I found it to be one of the most powerful tools I can offer clients. I thought it interesting that the dream interview method borrows its central concept of having the client interpret the dream from Gestalt therapy, yet she neglected to acknowledge this. In fact, not only did she omit a thank you to Gestalt therapy, she lumped it with Freud and Jung, who both rely heavily on expert interpretation. At any rate, you know, I have to say that yes, they do engage in interpretation, but it's also based very much on the client's associations. And so I think often you end up in the same place. Although I heartily endorse the Gestalt method as well, and I've used it plenty myself. So going back to his note, at any rate, I can appreciate that the dream interview method is more adaptable than a pure Gestaltian process and look forward to learning more about it in my own time. This is hopefully the first of many emails to you. I want to say again how much I enjoy your show and have found so much wisdom in the podcast, Brian. And see, he's a professional. I'm sure he doesn't mind my reading his full name and his alphabet soup. So this was from Brian Cerna, MANCCQMHP, and CADC2. I know what MA means, but I don't know the rest. He's adult outpatient director, and he doesn't say at which clinic, but it is in Oregon, Roseburg, Oregon. So I think that better wrap it up for today for the emails. As I mentioned earlier, Sony Pictures is a new sponsor for this and the next three shows. One of the things that got me excited about their upcoming film, We Own the Night, is that it stars Mark Wahlberg, among others. I've really been enjoying his work of late. I remember people talking about him in the remake of Planet of the Apes, but of course he was in an ape costume, so I wasn't particularly aware of him in that movie. However, there were two recent films that really brought him to the fore for me. The first was Four Brothers, and the other was last year's The Departed, which was quite violent but had a really great plot with a number of unexpected twists. And Jack Nicholson was also his devilish good self in that one. And checking on the internet, I see that Mark Wahlberg was in a number of other films that I enjoyed before. I was particularly aware of him. For me, these would include I Heart Huckabees, The Italian Job, The Perfect Storm, Three Kings, and Boogie Nights. Those aren't his only films, but those are all films in which I enjoyed his performance without being aware of him as a star. And on the internet, I've also discovered that he was an executive producer for 18 episodes of Entourage, an HBO series that I've really enjoyed. And it turns out that he's also a producer of the upcoming We Own the Night, which gives me yet another reason to recommend it to you and for me to want to see it. My next show will feature an interview with Alan Kanner, PhD, and we'll be discussing psychology in relation to disturbing trends having to do with globalization and the commercialization of childhood. Don't miss it. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.